Jason Turner joins us, Chief Investment Strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. Hey, Jason, how are you today?
Doing well. How are you, John?
Good. You're not outside, are you? I don't hear a lot of wind.
No, not out in the wind. Not today.
Retail sales rose 0.5% in March amid an inflation jump. Import prices hit an 11-year high. There's lots of moving numbers these days. In some ways, people aren't feeling the pinch, and in other ways, they absolutely are. My point being that some of the market indices aren't off as much as you might have guessed, but boy, inflation is sure taking a bite. What numbers are you paying most attention to today?
You hit on a few of those there, John. You saw the retail sales number, and you mentioned that. Retail sales continue to kind of march higher. Although it's important to note, retail sales aren't inflation adjusted when they report that headline number. So a big chunk of that retail sales gain was gasoline prices. Gasoline prices obviously are up significantly. So the nearly 40% increase in gasoline sales over the course of the last year, a lot of that's obviously due to the increase of the price of the pump, and that hits people in their wallets.
Yeah, you can't get around that. And then, of course, there's the trickle down from that, right?
Of course. You know, there's gasoline surcharges that are being added just about every delivery you've got, whether it's on the commercial or the individual side. And you mentioned, you know, changes to import prices, too, are also adding into those price pressures that we're all feeling when we go to the store.
Do you think other companies might do what Amazon is, I guess, going to do, add a 5% surcharge for fuel and inflation? They simply are going to say everything costs 5% more now, the gas and the cost of these things, and so you pay 5% more on Amazon. That's what it sounds like to me. That sounds pretty fast and pretty hefty to me. Do you think other companies will do something like that?
I think other companies already have. We've seen a lot of evidence, particularly of gas surcharges or transport surcharges being added into invoices across the landscape, and it's almost better to see that added in as a temporary gas surcharge than it is to see a wholesale increase in the price of the good.
Are you seeing that more B2B? Because I don't shop that much, but I haven't seen that on my receipts.
Definitely seeing a lot of it on the B2B side. I can tell you from talking to a number of manufacturing firms over the last month or so, there is a lot of B2B business where transport surcharges are really being added into the price. And as consumers, we're going to feel that in the end price of the good, whether it's a surcharge like Amazon's doing, or it's simply just the thing you're buying is going to be that much more expensive because they had to pay a surcharge for the gas.
Does this slow the production down or just makes it more expensive? We're so focused on supply chain. I wonder if these are impacting each other at all.
Yeah, I think the supply chain is challenged enough on its own with the problems we've had over the last 2 years in supply chain. You know, we see the Federal Reserve taking action now to move rates and slow the economy. That has impact on the demand side, but we're still challenged on the supply side. I don't think the price of gas alone is going to impact supply. They're able to pass it on through those fuel surcharges, but we're certainly going to see impact in the prices we all pay for goods. Coming forward, inflation won't just stop this month, even if we hit 8.5% on the headline number.
The supply chain observations every now and then sneak up on you, don't they? I'm in the market for a back door for one of my cars. It's got a little bit of a dent in it. So I've been calling some auto body shops, and they say, yeah, we'll be happy to give you an estimate, but don't ask us when we're going to get you a new door because the supply, I go, no, please don't say supply chain. They go, the supply chain for car parts is as bad as it is for cars.
It certainly is. It's parts across the landscape. My wife is absolutely sick of me saying it's just the state of the world as it comes to the supply chains. But that's certainly what we're all going to deal with. And that's not a problem that's going to fix itself in the short term. We need to see productive capacity pick back up. We really need to see more truck drivers on the roads delivering those goods. And once those problems start to work themselves out, it'll improve. But that's a multi-month improvement at best.
One last thing. Give me your thoughts on the S&P. We're on our way to another losing week, huh?
Yep, we are certainly on our way to another losing week. I think the market is starting to digest a lot of the earnings reports. We had some of the big banks report yesterday, kind of a mixed bag. A few of them reporting, obviously, healthy top-line growth, but pretty robust bottom-line growth. But others, we're starting to see some weakness, some banks building up larger credit reserves. We're starting to see banks get a little nervous about the future of the economy, and we'll see a little bit more evidence of that as some of the consumer products companies start reporting here over the next week and a half. And I think the market's just nervous with those earnings reports coming in, how much economic damage we may have already seen from inflation and or the situation in Ukraine.
Jason Turner is the chief investment strategist for Wintrust Wealth Management. WintrustWealth.com. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, John.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch, Joan Salzman joins us, senior reporter at CNET. Hi, Joan. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good. I'm just laughing at Tom Brady's tweet. He tweeted at Elon Musk today, "If you buy Twitter, can you delete the combine photo?" There's a famous photograph of a young college-aged Tom Brady standing next to a little sign that describes his particulars with his shirt off. It's at the NFL Combine. He is not the Tom Brady that you know today physically. He just looks like the kind of mope you'd kick sand on at a beach. And now he's Tom Brady. But that photo exists. He wants Elon Musk to delete that. Yeah, what do you make of Elon's designs on Twitter?
Right. Well, it's hard to know what to make of it, considering, you know, it was just within a week that he disclosed taking a significant share in Twitter to become its largest single shareholder. It's been longer than a week, but it's only been within a week when it was announced he would be joining their board, and then it was announced he would not be joining their board. And now we know why he's not joining the board, because joining the board would limit the total stake that he could take and make him make a commitment to fiduciary duties. And he wants to buy the whole thing, but it is hard to make of it in the sense that he's the richest man in the world. He certainly has the money to do it. It's hard to know, you know, in his SEC filing where he said that he was disclosing that he was making this offer, the language that was used is, I've been thinking about it for the last couple of days. I've decided that I'm going to actually just take over the company. And you wonder what he'll decide after another couple of days.
I wonder if somebody at Twitter said to somebody else at Twitter, we should have had an edit button. I'm telling you, we should have. You know, everybody else hated it, but Elon Musk hated that fact, and he bought us. You know, I wasn't going to buy them. Elon could. It's just funny, though, because I don't think that device is perfect, that platform, but it's fully functional. This must be more than just a nuisance fix to him. He must have designs to blow it up even bigger, huh?
Yeah, well, certainly he has said that he doesn't believe that leadership can move fast enough to grow Twitter from what it is right now. As much as, you know, Twitter has a really outsized influence in circles like media circles and political circles. And so sometimes we forget just how much smaller it is than Facebook, for example, Facebook being the biggest platform and owning Instagram. It's certainly not just the edit button. He's also, you know, he's pretty much a free speech absolutist. And so there are implications around what Twitter, if in a scenario that Elon Musk is successful with this deal, you would, you know, wonder what that means if restrictions that prevent things like hate speech, things like harassment on Twitter, if those are rolled back under leadership of somebody who values free speech more so than those sort of restrictions, what Twitter could eventually come to look like, how it will be changing.
In other words, he might put Donald Trump back on the platform.
Possibly. I mean, if there's the potential, this idea of deplatforming, which is a little bit of a misnomer, but the idea that people shouldn't be banned for what they say is something that would definitely, I would imagine, would be an issue that, given his past statements, he would want to reconsider.
That would resonate with him. Speaking of Facebook, you mentioned that a moment ago. Mark Zuckerberg says that AR glasses are the holy grail device that will redefine our relationship with technology. Wow, really? I mean, I know those are cool, but those must be more important to the world than I realize.
Well, it's certainly very important to Mark Zuckerberg's vision of where the world is going. You know, the whole reason that we're getting hit over the head with people talking about the metaverse and how everything's part of the metaverse, I mean, that really kind of boils down to Mark Zuckerberg and how in the last year he's laid out this sort of virtual and augmented reality as being the future of computing, just as computers were a few decades ago. And then in the last 15 years, smartphones have been. He sees things like AR glasses as being that turning point where a virtual world overlaid on top of the real world can make whatever you want to define the metaverse as. He sees that as the turning point in reaching that point.
That makes me kind of sad. I mean, as much as our devices annoy us for the apps and the way we use them, they are sort of aids or tools for the real world. When you put goggles on, you're living in something that isn't the real world. I hate this image of human beings not interacting in a real way, but in a virtual way. Am I overestimating that?
No, I think there's definitely grains of truth in a lot of people that are critical and skeptical about this concept of moving towards the metaverse. But one thing to keep in mind is with augmented reality glasses, it's not like a virtual reality headset like Facebook and Meta make now with Oculus, where you put it on, you are completely immersed in a different digital environment and the real world disappears. AR glasses allow you to still be able to talk to somebody face-to-face and see your world, but there would be digital overlays on top of that. So I don't know if that reassures you at all. Probably not.
That's helpful.
The idea,
no, that's not all bad. But then, so what does that look like, Joan? So I see across the room and I see Pete, but I could also see an opaque screen with data if I wanted, something like that?
Yeah, and it could. And so according to this report, Meta's aiming to launch their glasses by 2024 and then have more advanced devices come out every 2 years after that in 2026 and then 2028. But that's certainly what we've seen in the past as people have developed AR face-worn devices, as you would have things like, if you remember like Minority Report, where you could have interactive displays in front of you that you could move with your hands, even if they aren't actually there. That's obviously a dystopian look at it, and Mark Zuckerberg sees a utopian version of that. But we will get to see their definition of what that looks like in what seems like a couple years.
What an interesting observation. Joan Salzman, senior reporter, CNET. Read more about that at CNET.com. Let's talk next week. Joan, thanks for your time today. Boom. I think that was her disappearing, just like that, virtually. Dale Buss, veteran journalist, founder of something called the Flyover Coalition, a frequent guest here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Dale.
Good afternoon.
So you are interested in and writing about, I've read your report, on the business of agriculture in the Midwest and the cost of food and food inflation. I could have written that report. It's going up. End of story. Right, Dale?
Well, not necessarily. And unfortunately, as I said, the most recent report I think we got yesterday shows inflation overall and, including the cost of food at restaurants and in the supermarket continuing to go up. But the picture, may not be quite as dire as it seems. I know that this will continue to be a problem for quite some time. We all know the reasons, right? We had the supply chain snafus of the last couple of years, the plant shutdowns, including a lot of food processing plants because of COVID. And now we've got this war in the Ukraine, crimping grain supplies, and just kind of adding to worldwide anxiety over this. But I had an interesting conversation the other day with a man named Michael Swanson, who's the chief agricultural economist for Wells Fargo, a big national bank, but he's based in Minnesota. He's got heartland roots. He really understands how the agricultural and food economies work. And he said, since the 1940s, which is as far back as these statistics have been taken, food inflation has always receded after spikes like the one we're seeing now. And his optimistic take was that as we continue to see healing in the U.S. economy, as we continue to see trucking and factories and other aspects of the supply chain kind of working their way back to normal, which he has observed mm-hmm. they're gradually doing, he thinks that we are going to have a much better outcome toward the end of the year on inflation than we're looking at now. And he also said that it's dependent on having a good crop this summer. He said right now the weather seems like it's lining up pretty well in that regard. We're getting to the planning stage, that crucial point for all farmers. And he says, that as the crop continues to look good through the summer, as it's expected to, that the market will reassess the risks, and that'll also help simmer prices. So, it's hard right now, maybe as inflation keeps raging, to have a more optimistic outlook. But this guy's been following the ag economy for 20 years for Wells Fargo. They have to know what's going to happen as they place their bets, what farmers and companies to back. And so that's kind of his assessment.
Is it true that Americans spend less as a percentage of their annual income on food than in other countries? I don't know if that's any consolation to people who are food-strapped or cash-strapped right now, but I think we pay less as a percentage of our annual income on food than they do in other parts of the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's been true for a long time. And Dr. Swenson had an interesting take on that. He said inflation is experienced in this economy and a lot of Western economies, of course, as improvement in food. He said prices go up, but look at the value that you get for what you're paying, the more that you're paying. So you look at the kind of varieties of food that we have now that, you wouldn't have had certainly a generation ago, maybe 20 years ago, 10 years ago. You could look at flavors, look at enhancements in packaging. And even if you look at like produce, produce now is packaged much more efficiently and safely now than even a few years ago.
Okay, that,
with a lot of innovation.
I'll take that point, but I think a lot of us, just off the top of my head, would say, all right, I will let you shrink the cereal aisle 20% if you put 20% more cereal in the box, because what people notice now is food shrinkage, package shrinkage, right? So if the price is
absolutely
the same, the content is not as high.
Right. Well, and in times of high inflation like this, a spike in inflation, those are steps that food companies are taking so they don't have to raise prices nominally. But of course, that's exactly what you're saying. You're not getting a lot more value now, but he's saying historically, the food value has gone up as prices have gone up. But people still kind of experience that as inflation. Right now, the food companies are just kind of scrambling to do whatever they can to keep customers coming and to kind of hide to the extent they can the inflation that they're seeing in their own costs.
Yeah, maybe. I don't want to say they're doing us a favor, but maybe if the box is a little smaller, I do come out with a box of cereal and it's not as expensive as maybe it could have been. Dale Buss is a veteran journalist and founder of the Flyover Coalition. It's a very interesting report. You'll find out more about this at flyovercoalition.org, flyovercoalition.org. We'll catch up more next time, Dale. Good to talk to you today.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
1242 WGN Radio. Are we ready, by the way, with another Business of Food report? And Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Former Illinois Public Health Director Dr. Ngozi Ezike has been named president and CEO of Sinai Chicago, one of Chicago's largest hospitals. Cranes reports Ezike will take over in June. She joined IDPH in 2019 as the first black woman to head the department. Ezike was the face of Illinois' pandemic response. She helped Governor Pritzker explain COVID-19 to residents and create policies to combat the virus. Chicago's guaranteed income program will begin accepting applications in less than 2 weeks. It'll be one of the largest pilot programs in the U.S. Applications start on April 25th and last until May 13th, when a lottery will be held to choose 5,000 families who will receive $500 a month for a year. The program will cost the city about $31 million. Eligibility includes pandemic hardship and not making more than 250% above the federal poverty line. Information can be found at chicago.gov. That's chicago.gov. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
The Business of Food and Steve Alexander.
John, you were talking earlier today about how songs can take us back to particular memories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Smells can do the same, for me anyway. Anytime I smell vinegar, it reminds me of when I was a kid, and when my kids were kids, of dying Easter eggs. Which brings me to today's Business of Food, which is, it's kind of a public service message about Easter, which reminds me of Jim Gaffigan.
Easter, the day Jesus rose from the dead. What should we do?
How about eggs?
Yeah, how about eggs? Where'd that tradition come from? Ann Eflin is the USDA's history expert who says it goes way back.
The Persians and Egyptians actually exchanged eggs that were decorated in spring colors as a way of celebrating the spring. The early Christians sort of adopted that.
Okay, well, there's a lot of dying and hiding about to happen before this weekend, and the Kane County Health Department sent out a notice urging us to be extra careful when handling eggs. And the USDA's Meredith Carruthers says that begins with washing our hands before and after.
Because eggs can technically have salmonella on the shell, not just inside the egg.
Doesn't boiling kill all the bad stuff?
The shell itself is actually very porous. Things can pass through it.
And who knows what's on your hands. So, after boiling them, stick them in the fridge, and when decorating, she says to be sure and use food-grade dyes. I guess magic markers aren't a good idea. Crack an egg, throw it out. For egg hunts and other activities, only use refrigerated eggs, and if they're part of a hunt outside.
Not knowing what they potentially have touched or come in contact with, it's better just to not eat them.
And remember the two-hour rule. If the eggs are unrefrigerated for more than 2 hours, don't even think about eating them.
Does that help answer all your eggy questions?
Yeah, all of mine. But if you have more, here are two resources. Kane County has a page on food safety at kanehealth.com. Yeah, the USDA has a meat and poultry hotline, 888-MP-HOTLINE. By the way, some of our eggs do come from Illinois, but most are from Iowa and Indiana, the two biggest egg-producing states. And thanks in part to inflation, and in large part to bird flu, retail egg prices this year are over 20% higher than last year. Also, as we continue to wait for it to warm up, I know it's still early. Today is National Gardening Day. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Don Butler's in our studio, Vice President of Capital Electric. This is a Bensenville company. Don, welcome to the studio. The company does what? What do you guys do?
So we're a renewable energy contractor, but we really specialize in the electric vehicle chargers.
No kidding. I'll bet business is, well, how is business these days?
You know, it's we've been really busy, especially through the pandemic. We've been extremely busy with, you know, the popularity of electric cars. Now that people are having a more difficult time getting a hold of cars, it's kind of stable, but nothing huge. I mean, we're still installing anywhere between 6, 7, 8 a day.
So Capital Electric, before there were electric cars everywhere, what were you doing then?
So we're also a renewable energy contractor, our solar contractor, that so we do solar panels on both residential and commercial buildings.
Well, we always talk about the green wave, but I never know how big the wave is. Are people becoming increasingly interested in renewable energy, solar power?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, solar power and electric vehicles really go hand in hand. You put a few extra panels on your house, and now you have enough power to charge your car.
Well, do people power their homes with electricity from the sun?
Absolutely. So they can not only power their house, right? Typically during the daytime, you're producing additional energy where you're either sending it back on the grid or you're charging a battery back up for nighttime use.
Are there government subsidies for that? There used to be programs.
Yeah. So there's still a 26% federal tax credit on solar that does reduce to 22% next year. And then they have the SREC program through the state that is paying, is on residential systems, as much as 25% of the cost of the system.
How do people feel about the aesthetics of that?
You know, I think people are starting to get used to it. There are some people I've done on the North Shore where they're proud to have them on the front
of
the house.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I was out in California a few years back, and I was in a subdivision, and the house that looked odd was the one that didn't have solar.
Didn't have them, yeah. And I suppose, too, there's ways to not necessarily hide them, but not feature them on the front of the house if you don't want to, right?
A lot of people prefer to have them on the side or in the back. Yeah. But sometimes you don't have a choice. I mean, you're going to get your best production on the south side.
Yeah, we put ours in the basement, and we get terrible production out of the thing. So, but back to car charges for a minute. If I buy a Tesla or a Chevy, an electric car, I then have to have a charger at home, right?
Well, you'd have to have a means of charging. So a lot of manufacturers do come with portable cords that plug into a 240-volt receptacle. Some cars don't. They just give you the 110 cord where you would need a means of charging the vehicle.
Well, what would you sell me that would usurp that? What would be better than that? It's something, I guess, that goes quicker, huh?
Well, yeah. So on the level two, right now, what I'm seeing is the maximum acceptance rate on most cars is 48 amps. Some of the older Teslas got as much as 80. The cars now and all the other automakers, pretty much the maximum acceptance rate is 48 amps, which is a 60 amp circuit. If you want that, I can't use a receptacle. You would need some sort of a safety switch or a wall connector.
So people that buy these electric cars, that's interesting. I guess it would take longer to charge it in the garage, say, if I was just plugging it into the wall, right?
Yeah, but, you know, look at it this way. Most people don't fuel up with gas every day. You're leaving with a full charge. I want to say full charge 80, 90%. You don't want to charge up to 100%. But you're leaving with a full charge every day, right? And depending on what level charger you go with and what amperage depends on how fast the car charges. Now, I drive 200 miles a day. I drive a Model Y. And sometimes I'll play with the charger as far as what amperage would it take me to complete my charging before I wake up or have to leave. And it's usually about 12 amps. So I can have it charge slower all through the night. You can also set it up where if you're on hourly pricing when electricity fluctuates hourly.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, you can schedule the charging so it comes on in the early morning hours.
I hadn't thought about that. Does it, in a 24-hour cycle, does the cost of electricity change?
If you're on hourly pricing.
So that's something I can set up. Hourly pricing for electricity?
Yes, that is something that you have to apply through ComEd.
But then lo and behold, there you are saying, okay, fine. I want, so then what does that mean? Hourly pricing, okay. But when I'm going to be using electricity is during the, I guess, in the summer I would have the air conditioning running. And that's the most expensive time then during the day, I would guess.
Yeah, so typically afternoons through the evening hours, it's going to spike. You just have to monitor it, right? You can get an app. You can see how much electricity is at any given time. You can set up text alerts when the price is going to spike. But for the most part, the majority of the year, you're going to save charging your car at night at the cheaper rates.
Don Butler's in our studio, the vice president of Capital Electric in Bensenville. So the customers you're looking for now, are they people to electrify their homes with solar or to charge their cars with solar power?
Both. The majority of our work is electric vehicle chargers, right?
Yeah, right.
But people that get electric cars, I mean, our goal is to try to sell them solar, right? Because the two do work hand in hand.
I hope the government continues to subsidize these sorts of programs. Do you see that happening?
Well, hopefully the new version of the Build Back Better plan gets passed through.
And that's woven into that, right?
It is, yes. I mean, I don't know all the details, but yeah, there's definitely incentives for both solar and electric vehicle chargers in there,
and some that are in place right now, anyway, right?
They're on the electric vehicle charging side, no.
No, but I was speaking about home.
On the solar, yes. Yes.
Don Butler, Vice President, Capital Electric in Bensenville. Capital Electric with a K, capitalelectric.com is the website. It's really intriguing, Don. And as electric car sales pick up, you need to check in again. I appreciate you coming into the studio today.
No, thank you.